Sure, I'd continue to get that funny feeling around guys, but it might not be a recognizably gay feeling, let alone a fully formed desire for gay sex. Or he might have grown up to be a priest. That was my plan, actually. I entered a religious order at 19. It was there during formation retreat that I met other openly gay people for the first time, fellow candidates, brothers, and priests. By then I knew enough about the world that those funny feelings had morphed into recognizably gay feelings, and yet I still emphatically and sincerely believed I was not gay. Of course, I knew that I lacked straight feelings, and I knew at least implicitly that a person with gay feelings but no straight feelings is gay. This, from someone who would later teach elementary logic. Somehow, by not letting certain ideas in my head touch each other, I could refuse to draw the obvious conclusion from them. At least, I could refuse to do so until I met these other people who were doing so. My openly gay friends in the order let me know that gay life and gay sex and gay relationships were possible, and so I left to explore those options. Hannon would be horrified, and perhaps the local bishop would have been too, but my spiritual director practically sang "Climb Every Mountain" as I walked out the friary door. The new regime, which allows for such alternatives, strikes many of us as a very good thing. It's not because we believe that desire satisfaction is always good. Sexual desires in particular can powerfully incline people to favor short-term pleasure over long-term welfare, as Christian moral teaching has long and properly noticed. It's rather because we recognize that a small but significant portion of our fellow human beings are predominantly attracted to persons of the same sex, and that previous generations' tendency to ignore or hide or stifle this fact did far more harm than good. It's because we believe that romantic love is a good thing, and, more controversially, that the sexual expression of that love can bear good fruit even in relationships where procreation is neither intended nor possible. It's because the categories of sexual orientation were, are, and will continue to be useful. For some of us, it's not that difficult to imagine life without such categories. For my generation, mid-40s, and older, that was the experience of our childhood, by which I mean that it was the only world of which we were aware. Our parents and teachers and pastors made sure that we were sheltered from those people, our television shows kept them hidden, our books were censored. To the extent that we learned about such topics at all, it was as something distant and pathological, surely nothing that applied to us kids. The result? Confusion, isolation, loneliness, fear. The sense that I must be the only one. We may not have understood our funny feelings, but we knew enough to keep quiet about them. It was an ugly, painful time. To be clear, Hannon is not asking for a return to the 1950s, when the categories of sexual orientation were available but hidden. He's asking for something much more difficult for us moderns to imagine, a world without sexual orientation as we understand it. Yet it's hard to see how to avoid the closet as a necessary first step toward this goal. Worse, one worries that aiming for this goal would at most achieve a disastrous middle ground, a world where orientation categories were still salient but where the taboo against voicing them would leave those with same-sex desires lonely and miserable. Which brings me back to Hannon's essay, which is by turns incisive, naive, and scary.